call the meeting to order, please?
Oh, are you? Good, I'll be there.
Could we have a roll call?
Mins.
Here.
Moss.
Here.
Cable.
Here.
Sherwood.
Here.
McBride, Moore, and Smith are absent.
At this time, we would entertain any comments from the public concerning things that are not on the agenda tonight. If anybody would like to bring up anything, now's the time to do that. Hearing none, we'll move on. We need to, is there any corrections? Oh, no, excuse me. We need to approve tonight's agenda. Are there any additions or corrections to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll stand as is. Approve of minutes. Is there any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, I'd entertain a motion to approve.
I so move.
A second?
Second.
Minutes have been approved and seconded. I think we're down to the public hearing now. We'll start with the item 6.1, Roland Veterinarian Clinic. Jerry?
Yeah, I'm going to work on the present the rezoning, which is 02-19. Marcus will present the conditional use permit, which is 07-19. The rezoning request is from A1 Agricultural District to the A2 Agribusiness District. The conditional use permit is for a boarding operation for dogs. And they also have a home business permit that we issued for grooming. And so what we would like to do is we'll go through the PowerPoint, provide the background information, and then I'll present the rezoning, and then we'll stop. Because this is a public hearing item, we'll take questions from the Planning and Zoning Commission and then any comments from the general public, and then we'll ask for a vote on the rezoning, and then we'll move on to the conditional use permit request, which is also a public hearing.
Okay.
The applicants will not be here. They had a conflict. Again, this is a veterinarian who is the applicant, and he had a conflict, so he could not be here today. So property owners are Garth and Kristen Robinson. And do you want the lights on or off? Stephanie, are you trying to get my
attention?
Right?
The mic.
Okay. So the property owners are Garth and Kristen Robinson. They're at 5892 730th Street in Roland. The property is located in Section 16. Property is zoned A1 Agricultural District. Current land use is a veterinary clinic. It was also the site of a previous vet clinic. It was operated under the home business permit requirements. This particular vet, veterinarian and property owner cannot meet the current requirements with regard to employees. They have more employees than what the home business permits, which is one person beyond those that might reside in the dwelling. And so they have four full-time employees and six part-time employees. Future land use designation is rural residential district. Cities within close proximity, within 2 miles, is City of Roland, which they're to the east, and Story City to the northwest. The districts in this location are Roland Story School District, Story City Ambulance, Roland Fire. It's in the Iowa Regional Utilities Association area, and it's in the Keegley Branch South Skunk River watershed. This is a vicinity map. You can see the red star. That's the location of the property. We're at the intersection of 130th Street and 590th, which is just west of the city of Roland, about an eighth of a mile. This is the city of Roland, city of Storrs City is to the northwest. Property is surrounded primarily by agricultural land use, large parcels. There's also an animal operation, a turkey, CAFO operation to the west. On the east side of the street, the part of the property is being used for like a Christmas tree farm operation. To the southeast, within 600 feet of the vet clinic, there is a single-family dwelling, which is right in this area. And then to the east of that is a cemetery that's owned and operated by the city of Story City. Closer view, the subject property and all the land surrounding it, for the most part, is A1 agricultural district. There is a A2 agribusiness district in the southeast corner of that intersection of 590th and 130th Street. It was zoned back in the 70s, 1977, for a like a pork auction processing facility that never got developed. It's currently in agricultural use. Background.
So a little bit of background on this. The previous property was, or the previous property owner in 1996 created the veterinary clinic there, and the dwelling. Again, they were under a home business permit, and that home business permit does not allow boarding of animals, which that ties into the CUP later on. The subject property used to be a farmstead. In 1918, a barn was built in 1900 hog building, and those still remain on the property. That barn is used for treating of large animals, and when we did our site visit, there was two horses there at the time. The dog runs are located on the property for the boarding dogs as well as patient dogs that are screened on the northern side of the veterinarian clinic. 2002, a steel building was constructed for the veterinary clinic to support that home business permit. The building is set back further than 60 feet. And when we were there, we noticed that where they were wanting to put the boarding line, they would have to put another fence in on the inside, and they agreed to do that. There's a sign that was existing. They're still using that sign. They just replaced it with current property owners. So kind of getting into the rezoning again, it's being required as use is expanded beyond what is permitted under the home business permit. Standards for the home business in section 8901 include that not more than one accessory building may be utilized and only one person living outside of the residence and members of the immediate family thereby residing in the dwelling may be employed. The current property owners and veterinary purchased the property in August of 2018. Issues meeting the standards for home business permit were noted when they submitted their annual renewal for their home business. There are currently 4 full-time staff members and 6 part-time staff members, obviously exceeding the home business use. On average, the clinic sees 16 clients a day. They're open from 8 a.m. to 5 on the weekends and 8 a.m. to noon on Saturdays. The grooming area has been added to the former clinic that used to be located in the dwelling before that they created the actual clinic. The current veterinarian is Dr. Robinson, is a small and large animal veterinarian. The applicant indicated that the closest large animal practices besides their clinic are in Hubbard, Melbourne, Jefferson, and the ISU Veterinarian Hospital. Dr. Robinson has specialized in large animal veterinarian service for 23 years. He specializes in fertilization for bovine and equine, and also equine dental services. And states that the ISU Veterinary Hospital isn't able to provide equine embryo or semen collection. property has a gravel circulated driveway to accommodate trailers for those large animals. It also allows for people, after dropping off their animals, to approach 130th with being able to look at traffic instead of trying to back out there, making it safer for everyone involved. And again, they are not proposing any site improvements. This is just to bring the current use up to the standards of having the what they're doing now to bring it current. So, and Jerry went over the location and the uses nearby. Pictures, that's the new sign. It's not lit. We verified that while we were there previously, it was lit. It shouldn't have been, but when we were out there, they had taken all that out of there. So facing north, that's the home. The left side of that, which would be west, is where the new grooming home business permit is. Facing east towards the city of Roland, south across 130th, and there's the existing barn from 1918, and the clinic is just right there to the right.
Okay, these are the items that the planning staff and the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Board of Supervisors are to consider. This is in the Story County Land Development Regulations 92.06, sub 2. There's several items. The first one, the proposed rezoning shall conform to the Story County Development Plan, which is the C2C plan. The C2C plan compatibility matrix indicates that the A2 district is compatible with the ag conservation area and the commercial industrial area. Those are the land use designations. Applicant has requested a C2C future land use map amendment to the commercial industrial area. Given that the clinic, in this case the Roland Veterinary Clinic, specializes in both large and small animals, the intent of the commercial industrial area is met as it's best suited for a rural area. The principles for the commercial industrial area are further discussed in the section that follows. Two, the proposed rezoning shall conform to the statement of intent for the proposed district. Again, this is from the land development regulations. It says the A2 district is intended and designed to provide for those activities strongly interrelated with ag uses and must therefore be located in agricultural areas. It's supposed to be surrounded by agricultural areas. There's a requirement that the land evaluation site assessment for the property not exceed the 267 or 267 and greater. If it did, then that would represent that the property would be highly productive for agricultural use, and there is no row crop land in production. The land evaluation site assessment for this property was 238. Because of the services for large animals provided by the clinic, the proposed use is interrelated with ag and requires more of an agricultural setting. Again, there's no land in production. Farm ground is surrounded on each side. There is that A2 agribusiness district on the southeast corner of that intersection that we mentioned that was approved in 1977. Currently, it's in row crop production. The third thing to consider is the proposed rezoning shall be compatible and with surrounding land uses and development patterns. While all adjacent land uses are ag, the location is also compatible with development patterns in the area. Within a quarter mile, there are three parcels in addition to this subject property that contains single-family dwellings. As I mentioned, the closest dwelling, though, is to the southeast. It's about 600 feet from the vet clinic to that dwelling. The property is on a paved road, county road, which is 130th. There's also access to I-35 on that road. The city of Roland and the Roland Industrial Park is located in the northwest corner of the city, about a quarter mile to the east. And we think the location strikes a balance between having the needed infrastructure. They'll continue to use on-site septic. They've got a paved road. No improvements to buildings are proposed, no additions, no new buildings. They're going to use the same access and drive for the use of the property. This one deals with making adjustments if there's natural resources on the site. There are certain things that need to take place if that's the case. In this particular property, there are no natural resources, so it's not applicable. Five, again, to request the rezoning, to consider it, it has to have a score that's under 267, which it does for land evaluation site assessment, was 238. Additional things to consider with regard to the C2C plan. This is in section 92.08, sub 1. The extent to which the change would be consistent with the comp plan goals and policies, I'm not going to go through all those. A few of those, AR1, will protect agricultural practices in areas with prime soils and viable ag interest. Under cultural resources, CR1, new development in unincorporated areas of Story County respects and enhances the area's rural character. In this case, we think it does. And then under the land use goal number 3, consider the availability and capacity of local services infrastructure when determining future land uses. Additional things to consider with regard to commercial and industrial areas. Principle 7 talks about encouraging proposed development to take access off of existing paved roads, which is the case here. And then in summary, again, it had a low land evaluation site assessment of 238. No land will be taken out of ag production for this use. They're going to use the same access. It's the same use that it's been prior to them acquiring the property. So it's an established use. There's a requirement for the CUP that there be a 50-foot setback from the kennel and the actual buildings. There's also an established tree line along the north area of the property, which provides a buffer. Property is located on a paved road with relatively high traffic, with access to I-35 and close proximity to the city of Roland. They are providing care for large animals, large livestock, and this is a service that's beneficial in this part of the county. And again, they've been it's been this use at this location for about 23 years. Evidence demonstrating that the reasons why the plan should be changed, including but not limited to whether new information has become available since the comp plan has was adopted, that supports reexamination of the plan, or that existing or proposed development offer new opportunities or constraints that were not previously considered. Typically, parcels are designated in the C2C plan based on tax classification. That's one of the criteria. In the staff report, we provided a pretty thorough response from the assessor's office on the taxation change. It'll be dual class, multi-residential and commercial because of the use, and there will be an adjustment made to the property owner's taxes, which we communicated to the applicant. The reclassification is not due to the rezoning, but it's based on the use of the property. C, whether or not the change is needed to allow reasonable development of the site. The proposed amendment will allow the site to continue to be used as a vet clinic, which it was first established as a vet clinic since 1996. The current zoning of the A1 district, in the current A1 zoning district, a vet clinic is not a permitted use. That's why they're needing to request the change to A2 agribusiness. As we mentioned, it was a previous home business that was established by the previous veterinarian. And as Marcus mentioned, there's no plans to make any improvements to the existing facilities. The relationship of the proposed amendment to the supply and demand for the particular land uses within the county and immediate vicinity of the site. Again, Dr. Robinson's a small and large animal veterinarian. The closest large animal practices, as Marcus mentioned, are in Hubbard, Melbourne, Jefferson, and the Iowa State University Vet Hospital. He's been in practice for 23 years, providing these services unique to bovine livestock. The application indicates that Iowa State University Vet Hospital is not currently providing these services that he's providing. Within the vicinity, there's one A2 agribusiness district in the southeast part of that intersection, which we went over. The Christmas tree farms on the east side of the road as well. And there has been past and current demand for agribusiness and value-added agricultural production in the area. A demonstration that the proposed amendment has merit beyond the interest of the applicant. Given that clinic's growth and large animal services being provided, there's a clear demand for this type of business in the county and the region. As previously stated, the veterinarian, Dr. Robinson, is a small and large veterinarian and is the only one providing the services that he's providing. And again, there's a great need and benefit to the county. We pretty much covered most of these things. With regard to traffic, though, average daily traffic counts from the DOT, I think from 2015, indicate that there's over 2,600 trips generated on 130th Street. They have approximately 16 customers a day, and I think it's like close to 1% of an increase, if you want to refer to that as an increase. Again, it previously was a vet clinic. We don't know what their numbers were, but it will be a small change. We did have a conceptual review on May 30th for the rezoning and the conditional use. We received the application for both June 24. We did provide some comments. I think this is just part of what we communicated. If they propose improvements in the future, that they'll need to meet the county's general site requirements. The assessor, as I mentioned, did provide quite a lot of information, which we provided to the applicant. He's talking about a dual class taxation class that will be applied, and that taxes will increase slightly and they'll be payable in 2020. Animal control had questions about whether or not the state would inspect. They did provide a license from the state of Iowa, so that's already occurred. Questions about indoor and outdoor kennels. They're linked. Indoor and outdoor kennels are linked. They have a capacity to actually serve 40, but that 40 is for situations where families have more than one dog, and they don't plan on doubling up unless it's from, you know, dogs from the same household. Cities within 2 miles were notified July 23. We did hear back from the city of Roland. Their city attorney indicated that they have no position on this request, and we did not hear back from Story City. We sent notices July 24 to property owners within a quarter mile and posted or published notice rather August 1st in the three papers designated by the Board of Supervisors. We did have somebody come in and talk to planning staff about the request, who actually saw a sign. We also posted a sign July 22, and for the most part, I think he just had questions about what was being requested and wanted to make sure that this rezoning didn't impact his property. And so with regard to the rezoning request, things to consider, again, this site's been a vet clinic since 96. The compatibility matrix does indicate that it's compatible, the commercial industrial area. Within a quarter mile, there's 13 parcels. Three of those contain single family dwellings. The closest dwelling, again, is about 600 feet away to the southeast. We have that A2 agribusiness district located at the southeast corner of the intersection, but currently it's in row crop production. Talked about the land use. The LISA score is low. They're meeting all the setback requirements. Average number of clients is approximately 16 a day. And then we talked several times about the services that they provide. So with that, planning staff is recommending approval of the rezoning from the A1 agricultural district to the A2 agribusiness district. And that would be the first item. And it's rezoning 02-19. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Jerry. Does the commission have any questions for staff? Any public comments? Questions? Okay. I would entertain a motion.
I move for item one, to approve item one.
Okay, to approve the rezoning.
I'll second that.
I have a second. So we have a motion and a second. We do a roll call vote, please.
Mins.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Moss.
Yes.
Cable.
Yes. Motion passes. Now, conditional use permit, no?
All right, so we're going to go over the CUP here for the animal boarding. During our site visit, again, they were using the vet clinic was doing this in the past, so this was already set up for it. Of the 20 kennels that they have for dogs, there is 11 of them that have access directly to the outside through just moving those doors up, and on the other side of that is another kennel out there, so they can come and go however they decide how that works. Then there are the two cat kennels that they have, and then in this other room was the four other that makes the total 20 for dogs. And again, they're only going to ever reach that 40 number if a family has two dogs and requests that they be put in the same kennel. So this is the outdoor area for the boarded dogs as well as the patient dogs. Those are the outside gates or kennels connected to the inside. So right along this, the edge next to the garage door there is exactly 50 feet from the northern property line. They're going to install a fence right there because the boarded dogs per the CU, per our requirements, can't be within 50 feet of the property line. So right along there's exactly 50 feet. They're going to put in a new fence there so the boarded dogs only have that side, but then the patient dogs can be on either side of that per our conditions. Requirements. So compatibility, the animal boarding is compatible within this new A2 district once the rezoning has happened. Again, it'll allow the continuation of the services that the clinic has already been offering in this area. Animal waste is collected daily, and Shitty provides garbage service once a week to the property. It's surrounded by large agricultural parcels and 600 feet to the closest house. And again, that 50-foot setback will be met by them adding that additional fence in the back. There's an existing tree line to the north acting as a buffer. And so six of those 11 that allow the dogs to go back and forth are on the south side of the building. Those are the only kennels that you're able to see from not being actually on the property. And then the dog run is on the north side. You can't see that from the street for the most part. As far as traffic goes, it has that established loop drive, allows for easy traffic movement in and off the property. The clinic currently sees on average 16 patients a day, and that number is not expected to increase. And there is a sidewalk on the property for pedestrian use. Just when you bring the trailers and stuff, they have put in a sidewalk so that pedestrians don't have to be out there at all. They have 6 to 7 parking stalls depending on how people are parking there. They are going to add an ADA space for that first, or an ADA sign for the first space right next to the doors, and the parking meets all required standards. Sign is existing sign. Panels were replaced. It's not illuminated based on our site visit. Again, as far as environmental protection goes, no excessive noise, dust, vibration is anticipated, and the pens are cleaned every day. with, again, Shitty providing garbage service once a week. There's your normal criteria for approving CUPs. And staff is recommending, based on the information that we got from the applicant along with their answers to our questions, that the plan that the commission recommends approval of the conditional use permit application is put forth in case CUP 0719 with the following condition: the Roland Veterinary Clinic must request and obtain a conditional use permit modification before any additional kennels may be added. And there are the alternatives.
Any public questions or comments? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion.
I would move that the number two suggestion be affirmed.
Okay. So we have a motion to approve the conditional use permit with alternate number two. Do I have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Can we do a roll call vote, please?
Moss.
Yes.
Mins.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Cable.
Yes. Motion is approved. Okay, Jerry, are we ready to go on to our stormwater?
The planning staff provided a thorough review of the proposed stormwater drainage ordinance and erosion control ordinance. Amelia did a really good job of going through that at the July 10th meeting. We had a couple of stormwater professionals, one of those professionals is here today, who provided quite a few comments. We, at one point, were in a situation where we're trying to make adjustments on the fly, if I can use that word, and it got to a point where there was too much to consider, and it was recommended by the Planning and Zoning Commission that the item be tabled. And since that time, we have reviewed all of the comments. There were 12 major comments provided. We spent time talking to several of the jurisdictions who we've somewhat patterned the ordinance that we've been working on. I think we've been at this since the latter part of 2017, early part of 2018. This is not a model ordinance, but we're not creating the wheel here. This is an ordinance that's very similar to what other jurisdictions, counties and cities in Iowa have accomplished. We spent time talking to representatives from some of those jurisdictions with regard to the comments, and again, there were 12 of them, and responded to them in the form of the memo, which everybody, all zoning commissioners have a copy of the memo. And we sent that, our response to the 12 items, out to those who were at the meeting on July 10th, and we received, and then also we sent out to other individuals who provided comments who were not at the meeting, and we received comments from one of the individuals who was in attendance at the meeting. Our position is that we support and made adjustments to 8 of the 12 items. However, 4 of them we are suggesting that no change be made, so it's the same as what was proposed July 10. And so my goal is to go through what those items were, what were addressed at the July 10 meeting. I'm not planning on going through the ordinance. This ordinance amendment would be making an amendment to Chapter 85, which is the definitions chapter, and then mostly an amendment to Chapter 85.05, which is where the existing language is for erosion control and stormwater. So, again, my goal is to go through the points that were raised at the July 10th meeting. The first four, we are recommending that there be no change. There was a comment, the first comment was that the engineer should not be accepted from meeting the stormwater requirements. And the intent is that the county engineer would not be accepted. We would not be requiring the engineer to submit an application, but they will be required to meet the standards for erosion and stormwater. They also are required to meet the state requirements, which is the NPDES permit for improvements impacting disturbed area an acre or greater. Two, there was a comment made that our department should not be inspecting erosion practices or stormwater practices, and we fully intend to inspect practices. You know, we've been at this for several months now, and we've learned a great deal. A big part of my job before I came here was spent out in the field reviewing improvements with regard to stormwater systems, drainage systems, piping, restrictor plates, and you know, I spent a great deal of time looking at those improvements. Amelia has learned a great deal. She's received certification from the Iowa Stormwater Education Partnership for maintenance of stormwater practices, and she's also going to be certified in erosion and sediment control. So it's our intention to do these reviews when we do our preliminary inspection. We'll be checking the erosion control measures that are in place, and at least when we do the final, to check to make sure that the stormwater practices are in place. Because we don't have an adopted building code, primarily we're looking at zoning regulations, so you know, site improvements, building setbacks, heights, finished grade, that type of thing. And it will include the erosion and stormwater. Three, there's no minimum threshold for erosion and sediment control plan. Again, we're looking at a regulation for under an acre disturbed, and we don't have a minimum threshold. There was a suggestion that we have a minimum. We've encountered situations that involve small improvements, sheds, and larger that are close to property lines, and when you know, when these areas are filled, it can add to concerns with stormwater erosion control. So we're not recommending that we have a low end. Again, we won't be requiring erosion practices unless it's under an acre. Otherwise, if it's larger than an acre, the state's NPDES permit would be required. Final stabilization definition may preclude native plantings. That's number four. The definition of the final stabilization requires a uniform perennial vegetation or vegetative cover with a density of 70%, sufficient to preclude erosion for the entire disturbed area of its permitted project has been established, or equivalent stabilization measures have been employed. So those are the first four. We're recommending that there not be any change. That was similar to what we were proposing at the July 10 meeting. And then the items that we've made adjustments to are the next eight. The comment was redevelopment sites pose unique challenges and increased cost. The commission also had questions about the exception for maintenance of various site versus redevelopment. Water quality volume requirements, which require infiltration practices, pose unique issues for properties with septic systems and redevelopment sites. The solution, adding exception for infiltration of the recharge volume, which is part of the water quality volume criteria for sites with restrictions, The proposed water quality requirement is the site shall be designed to manage the water quality volume of a rainfall depth of 1.25 inches on site and to manage the corresponding recharge volume through infiltration practices. This is typical in the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual. Other communities such as Ames, Johnson County, and Dubuque County, the recharge volume is the volume required to infiltrate, to be infiltrated to ensure groundwater recharge. And then we talk about the version from July 10, and then what we are proposing, which is the information that's in red. The model ordinance provided in the Story County Watershed Assessment prepared by Edmonds and Oliver Resources includes exceptions to water quality volume for new development and redevelopment sites with restrictions. Dubuque County also provides an exception to the recharge volume requirement that is part of the water quality volume criteria. However, they noted that on sites where soil quality restoration is used, infiltration requirements are typically met. So I won't go through all of it, but generally when infiltration is infeasible due to the natural or existing physical characteristics of a site, including but not limited to, if the surface and underlying soils in NRCS Group D, which those the water does not penetrate through very well, have minimum infiltration rates less than 0.52 per hour, the measured groundwater elevation is less than a, and then these are some of the criteria. The groundwater elevation is less than 4 feet in depth, below the basin invert or infiltration surface bedrock or impervious soils are less than 4 feet. It goes on, talks about hot spots or contaminated soils, making infiltration or orientated BMPs, best management practices, hazardous. The site shall be designed to provide water quality treatment for the runoff resulting from a rainfall depth of 1.25 inches and alternative practices such as, and then these are some options, designing a treatment train, which we have a definition for, or we added a definition, constructed wetlands, four bays, retention, detention, ponds, filters, sand peat, underground sand, perimeter sand filter, the list goes on. Vegetated filter strips shall be implemented to the maximum extent practical with a goal, and this is the purpose of 80% reduction of the annual average post-development total suspended solids. Now, that's a goal. I think that's consistent with the state requirements. It's not a mandatory requirement, but it's the goal, the practice to work towards. And then we provide some information about the exception. This exception would apply to both new development and redevelopment. And then, like I said, we added the definition of treatment to train, which is a stormwater management best practices, where redundant treatments, you know, we use similar treatments, are provided, such as swales, biosales, filter strips, bioretention, or other practices for pollutant removal. Two, water quality, stormwater quality requirements may increase downstream flooding. Solution, allow designers more flexibility in designing to pre-development rates for the five-year storm or resettlement rates for a storm of the same intensity, whichever is less. And again, we make a point that it was our understanding that at the meeting this was something that was acceptable to those that were in attendance. The stormwater quality requirements in the current version are as follows. Stormwater management shall be provided to limit the post-development rate of runoff from the site during the five-year through the 100-year 24-hour event to the lesser of the following values. Runoff rates equivalent to those from a storm event of the same intensity and duration based on pre-development conditions, or runoff rates equivalent to those from the five-year storm event based on conditions which exist as of the date proposed. Improvement plans row crop cover, contoured in good condition. It goes on. The requirement matches that of the model ordinance from the Iowa Stormwater Education Partnership. Johnson County communicated to us that this is how their requirement is also interpreted, and they're updating their ordinance to clarify it. Three, requiring engineering analysis to show the selected practices meet stormwater management is burdensome. And again, we've had a lot of discussion after that meeting with some of the other jurisdictions, and we found that many of these things are required. It's, you know, when they're going through and designing sites to meet the requirements, these are things that they would have available that we are asking to provide. So under the red portion, identify the proposed stormwater management BMPs or low impact development practices selected for the site, their location, landscaping, stabilization, prevent their impairment, and any hydrology or hydrologic design calculations. Summaries, most, and then it goes on, most commonly these include, that list different things, the curve numbers, time of concentration, peak runoff rates. And then we note too above it that these are based on requirements that the Iowa Stormwater Education Partnership model identifies. City of Dubuque, Ames ordinances have checklists. Johnson County, City of Johnston also have similar requirements in their ordinance. Four, requirements for stabilization of disturbed area in the erosion and sediment control ordinance do not match state NPDES. And so we tried to make adjustments to that effect. And so the language is consistent with the state requirement. So it is now immediately required when work actually ceases. And so that's what the information in red identifies. Five, the requirements for stabilized construction entrance do not specifically refer to SUDIS standards. And so we made adjustments to the ordinance to reflect that. And we took out the specific provisions. So if they make adjustments, we wouldn't need to necessarily make amendments. Six is the requirement that disturbed slope lengths shall be broken up into several smaller slopes by installing silt fence, filter berms, filter socks, or other floated diversion sediment control BM best management practices as needed to prevent concentrated flow is vague. So there was questions about, you know, what slope are we talking about, and so the solution that we suggest is if stabilization practices are employed and runoff is maintained as sheet flow, little erosion typically occurs. So what we're trying to focus on here is where it's concentrated flow to prevent concentrated flows. The requirement has been clarified to state that there may be steep or lengthy slopes or signs of concentrated flows. Additional erosion control, BMPs, may be required and to follow the design considerations for selected practice in the SUDAS, which provide recommendation on different site conditions, such as slope. And so that's the language below it. Seven is buffer requirements from environmentally sensitive features and watercourses may not allow restoration and stabilization of areas in poor condition. Solution is that we are recommending is the existing provision for buffers encourages these areas to be revegetated where existing native vegetation does not exist. Standards for native revegetation may be used following the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual or other professionally accepted best management practices. Polk County had a ordinance that we thought was beneficial. And so it lists those things that you can do within that buffer area. One of them is number two, minor land disturbing activities for erosion control and bank stabilization or revegetation, which I think kind of also gets to like the cleaning up of debris, vegetation debris. So that would be a permitted activity. Where we have driveway accesses, utilities, public water supply intake, structures, trails, that type of thing. And then the last item is we did not have a definition of site, which we added. And so those are the major points that were made at the July 10th meeting. And like I said, we responded and made adjustments to eight of those comments, and we are recommending that the four, the first four, remain intact. And with those adjustments, we are recommending that the Planning and Zoning Commission support the stormwater and erosion control ordinance, and that the Board of Supervisors take action on the first consideration at their meeting on the 20th. Any questions?
Any questions for staff? Any public input or questions? Please state your name and address.
Scott Renault, Fox Engineering, 414 South 17th Street, Miami, Suite 7. Gary, you get my email. I sent it shortly before the meeting. All right, I have it here. I'm going to give it out to somebody if that's right.
Did you send that to me?
I sent it to you and Amelia both. Yeah.
It was before the meeting?
Yeah.
I'll
give that. So I appreciate Gary's efforts to kind of go through this and kind of deal with some of the issues. I'm going to go back to my very first discussion on this is I really want to keep it simple, all right? That's really my entire goal. You know, I've done 3,000 drainage projects. I can prove that as an attorney, maybe prove that once when I do an extra witness work, which I do a few of those in a year as well for various drainage problems. It's kind of my area especially. And so I've seen a lot of things and seen a lot of things go wrong. And typically when you try to make things more complex, things go wrong. And also, as much as I'd like to say my profession is uniform in this thing, they're not. The Iowa Stormwater Management Manual, I really dislike. I think it's a very poor document. Written by a college professor and using a bunch of mishmash other stuff that he pulled from other places and put it together. And but it, from a standpoint of functionality, it's poor. Right? It makes things very complex. And when you make things complex, especially in the stormwater world, you're going to make them fail. So I really have a couple of issues here, one of which is kind of in the goals for the county, and that's to improve stormwater quality. And then the other aspect is to improve issues with quantity, flooding, or downstream effects. I think most of the things you're going to see from neighbors are going to be downstream effects, erosion and those kinds of things. So that's the erosion component as well as some of the flooding component. To my mind is dealing with just directly with the erosion component is I don't understand why we're duplicating anything that has to do with the way the state sets up the regulation. If the county wants to do inspections, which I've never said I didn't want you to do, have I? I don't believe.
I think there was a discouragement. I'm not supposed to respond.
Well, my view is a lot of times we get comments back, and it's not my developer, it's the home builders. And I have a tremendous difficult time with home builders to do the right thing. So I don't disagree with observation and having somebody, you know, have a little stick. But when you're coming to the developer and it's the home builder and the lot's been sold, that's a different thing. And so I just want the people that are responsible for that thing, you know, the ones that are chastised. You cannot chastise me for the way a home builder is doing something on site. I have almost no control over that person. Now you can say the developer does, but honestly, not a lot in all cases. So the erosion control, if the county wants to have observation, that's fine, but make it clear what's the developer's responsibility and what's the homeowner's responsibility, and then do not duplicate anything that's in the state. The state code and a lot of those requirements change over time. They For instance, the erosion control seeding dates and whatnot, those have all changed relatively recently, where they want you to seed within 14 days if you haven't touched the site at all, which I think is really interesting, you know, in the middle of winter or if you get lots of other natural occurring things. You know, farmers don't farm when it's wet, but yeah, we're expected to, you know, make a site whole and then have all the erosion control in, right? It's difficult. So there's a lot of practicality there that is a little pushed to the extreme already. So really why I'm asking the erosion control off, if you want the county to do supervision, I don't have a problem with that. Make it clear what's the developer, make it clear what's the homeowner. And then otherwise, just adopt the state, just say you're adopting the state standards. This county can certainly ask to see your state permit. And then as far as the 1 acre thing is, I think you're just opening a can of worms. I know the county is getting gets calls and complaints, all right? That they have to try to resolve, and they're probably small. But at some point, you've got to call. You know, you have to have some sort of limit and say, well, you know, this is too small. I'm just not going to deal with that. It's not my problem. It's a neighbor problem. And there's other ways for neighbors to resolve problems. I kind of put it into the. There's always a 2% of things that go on that if you try to legislate for that, you're just going to drive yourself nuts because you'll never be able to legislate every little thing that's out there. I think that kind of falls into these small categories. So dealing with the complexity of the stormwater systems is, I don't believe it's appropriate to use this banner because it's more urban organized, and it's set up to meet EPA requirements for stormwater quality at a national level, and that's pulled down to now the communities are 50,000 and over, James Falls. So the communities are 50,000 and over are doing it. Johnson County and Dubuque County are the only two that I know of that have incorporated it into their for their own uses. And I think it's a mistake because I don't think it's an appropriate way to do rural developments. Rural developments have a lot of other both opportunities and challenges that urban developments don't have. For instance, I was thinking about this in the context of a couple of projects that will be in front of you here soon is if I have to design according to this, then I'm not going to do a lot of good things that I would normally. In other words, I have 500, on one project, I have 550 acres of drainage coming at me. So I could, if I have to do this to manage my own stormwater, I'm not going to do anything for the 550. It's just going to go right on by because I can't deal with it in the context of the complexity of this system. It'll just feel overwhelming. So I have to bypass that. If I don't have to worry about this and I'm doing my what I would think is correct, I can install a system that will address some of the issues that are coming from the 550 acres. You know, we can probably take care of almost all the sediment control from it. We can probably get the TSS down to 80 on that 550 acres by itself, but I cannot do all the other things when I have to deal with all the minutia of this ordinance and requirements. And you see that happen in design. Not only do we have to design for these, but we also review these from other people for the cities that we work for. So we get to see. We probably do 50 or 60 of these ourselves a year, and we probably review another 50 or 60 as well. So we get to see it all. We also get to see how they all fail. And the problem with the way that they fail is they just are overwhelmed because of the small requirements. For instance, I have a couple of systems that, to meet this 24-hour infiltration rate requirement, I have a little hole in my baffle plate that's as big as my finger. Is that going to work? No, absolutely not. It's going to get plugged up with it, just about anything that goes into the pipe. Do I have a plan B because I'm a smart guy? Yeah, I have a plan B. I have a way to make it work. Most of my brethren don't put the plan Bs in to make it work, regardless of how it's going to fail. All these stormwater systems are going to fail. It's just a matter of how. And you need to understand when they fail, how they're going to fail, and what they're going to do. And the way the stormwater manual is set up is it doesn't assume that. It assumes that really all these things are going to work. You know, we're going to say that this is going to happen and it's going to happen. It doesn't work that way. I can tell you that from going on extra witness on lawsuits. They do not work that way. So what do I want you to do? I want you to simplify. I want you to get rid of the infiltration requirement. I want to get rid of the channel protection volume. And I want to get rid of I wanted you to get rid of the overbank protection. So channel protection volume, water quality volume, channel protection volume. Just get rid of those. And the reason being is there are kind of minutia calculations that really confuse what you're trying to do on the site. I will give you a way to get to that with a much simpler situation, and a much simpler way to do that. And then that is, in the stormwater detention requirement, it says right now that you have to retain for the 5-year storm up to the 100-year storm in the elements, right? So what that means is, the way I read that, is that I have to detain the 5-year, I can discharge the 5-year existing condition, which is going to be this meadow condition. I can discharge the 5-year develop, or then I have to detain for the 5-year develop, but I have to do that for every storm all the way up to the 100-year. So the discharge rate is going up as I go. So I have a 5-year existing discharge rate, I have a 10-year, I have a 25-year, and I have a 50-year, and I have a 100-year discharge rate. So the discharge rate continues to go up. What I suggest you do, and it just simplifies this, and this is the way we used to do it a long time ago when we had a little more common sense as engineers, is we just have a 5-year existing rate and we detain up to the 100-year. So our flow rates never go up. All right? So we're trying to maintain that 5-year. So it's very simple, a lot easier system to design. All right? What it does is it takes care of those three things I just told you I wanted to get rid of: the overbank protection, the water quality volume, and the channel protection. Because it does all of those things by just one simpler calculation. The books that we create for to meet this requirement are about an inch thick. I can do this with the 5 versus the 100-year with 6 pieces of paper. It's that simple. And the systems then are designed in a way that they typically work and they don't fail. All right? These systems are going to be maintained long after I'm gone and long time after people leave. I do not believe that any of these systems should ever be on a private lot. A lot of the BMPs that are in here are private lot, individual things that people would do. You want to build a rain garden, you want to build a bioswale, you want to do something like that. What is a rain garden to the first person is a weed patch to the second person. They're going to disappear, they're going to be gone. And I don't know how the county's going to be able to manage to enforce that over time. I've seen Johnston County gave a presentation and they were going that route, and I'm like, this is nuts, because it's going to be 100% fail within 10 years. All that system's going to be gone, built. People, you know, they don't get permits to do little things. They just go ahead and do them, especially when they don't have any history with buying the property or what the requirements are. So I encourage systems. So if you do what I just told you to do, is then you're going to encourage systems that are group systems. In other words, offsite, not part of a lot, part of an outlot. And so those systems then, I think, are a little bit more, first of all, a little more reliable. Second of all, they're not on a property, so the homeowners association has to deal with it. And they have a purpose, and they look like they have a purpose. When you look at a bioswale or a rain garden, a lot of times they look like a weed patch, especially if your idea of a weed patch is anything where the grass is not mowed, right? Which is pretty typical. I have homeowners around some of my subdivisions where I have prairie grass, and they say, mow the weeds. And I'm like, it's beautiful prairie grass. Why do you want to mow it? But yet people want that, you know, they expect a certain thing. I'm always amazed when I go into the county and see people have huge lots and they mow the entire thing. And then they wonder why, you know, they don't have any wildlife, those kind of things. The only way to do that is to move those things off the property and into common property that's held by the homeowners association. So I want you to do an ordinance that kind of pushes everybody that way just naturally. You don't even have to tell them, because that's what's going to happen. You're going to have detention ponds or dry ponds or wet ponds, whatever it might be. They'll take care of that feature, and it happens without a lot of thought and effort, and it's an easier maintenance to take care of. And it'll also accomplish those three things that I don't think you should do anyway. Because those calculations, I wanted probably a few people to understand where those came from and why they're there. And honestly, it's a little bit hokey how they pulled all that together. It is not good science. It's not good math. It's just, it's more of, we wanted to accomplish this, we wanted to accomplish that, and they kind of pushed all these things together. And they came up with this unified sizing criteria, which also I think is a little out there. So I would just encourage it just to be made simpler. So a lot of what Jerry talked about, I didn't have a problem with. There is a couple pieces of the ordinance that say that if we want to make changes to erosion control or to the drain system, we have to get approval from the county before implementation. It's maybe not a problem in the stormwater area, but that's full of craziness in erosion control. because it's fairly frequent when I go on the site and say, well, what we're doing is not working, let's change this, and I don't ask anybody, it just gets changed. And so I'm not certain why I need to ask for permission to do implementation on an erosion control plan. That's a different thing. On the stormwater, I can kind of understand that. I have to tell you, I modify those all the time. You know, Jerry was talking about baffle plates, which control the flow. We change those all the time to mitigate circumstances or issues. And the reason we're doing that is just trying to, you know, we hear what the neighbors say and what's going on. We watch the system, and the systems don't always work like it's predicted. All right? We make lots of assumptions when we put these together. There's a lot of assumptions already included in this. And we never quite know how it's going to work. I'll give you an example. At Cameron Estates, you know, we built a pond, and it's huge. I mean, it's, comparatively speaking, to it only serves 7 lots. And I think, well, that's no problem. And we have a drainage district tile that comes into that. I guess how many acres were coming into that from that drainage district pond? And honestly, I've come to the conclusion it's either 7 acres or 140 acres, and I don't know which. You know, because it's so flat where it goes, I have no clue where any of that goes. So we changed how the pond operated so it works better, deals with what the downstream people are concerned about, but I didn't have to, you know, we just do that kind of a little bit on the fly in order to make that work. Because we don't always get these things figured out. I have a project in Ames that there's 8 different stormwater management plans for. And I have come to the conclusion that 7 out of the 8 are all wrong. Because of what the assumptions they made and the things that they did. And I was one of those, by the way. I was one of the 7 that was wrong. Only one guy got it right. Only one guy figured it out. And unfortunately for him, that was when the DOT required to do stuff in metric, and so nobody understood what he was writing. And so it didn't make sense to anybody. And not only that, because of the application, the way that worked, is when they changed the metric to the U.S. units to build it, they got it wrong, and they had the culverts going the wrong direction. So you see those kind of things happen. I don't like those things happening, but things happen, and I want them to be simple and easy to design. So that my young intern that I have in my office today can design those and get it right, versus having somebody that's got 20-some years of experience and wondering if this is going to work right when it gets done. So, made some good steps, still think it's too complicated. Erosion control, basically, I think you can get rid of almost the entire section. If you want to do the inspections, that's fine, but get that spelled out how you want to do that. But just take on the state standards. On the other part, it's really simple. You're just going to do a 5-year existing storm rate, and you can specify some criteria for that, and a 100-year detention rate for that. And then there's maybe a couple other things that I would put in there that would provide some security to you. Security meaning that, you know, we do get storms that are over the 100-year event. How I design now is different than what I designed 30 years ago. Storms have changed. There's no doubt about it. You know, it was fairly infrequent to see more than the 3-inch rain, you know, in a 5-year period. And now we seem like we have a 3-inch rain, you know, a couple times a year on our sites. So I do design differently. That's the other reason not to do this, the way it's set up here. When you have these large rainfall events, bad things happen. You get hail, you get sticks, you get tweet, you get everything's moving, and that's going towards all these structures and it's blocking. There was $1.5 million lawsuit in Marshalltown where they put in huge detention ponds to handle, I think, a 500-year event. They were really big. And if you go look at them, they're just off from Center Street. You drive down Center Street, look off to the left, and you'll see these gigantic ponds. They're huge. They have 12 or 14 foot of draft in them. In other words, they can fill 14 feet. Well, the first time it really got a heavy rain, they got a 6-inch rain, the corn stalks came whipping off the field, blocked all the intakes, so none of the water went to the ponds. All the ponds did not have, I think it went up 1 foot. So where did the water go? Well, it went whipping down and went down through a car dealership and flooded a car dealership. It caused about $1.5 million in damage. So there's all sorts of unintended consequences you get with these things. And when you add the complexity, it's even making it worse, all right? So that's my little spiel. I may be the only one that you're going to hear this from, honest to God, because this is my area of specialty. This is what I know. I've argued this in national conferences with people about how that we're doing these calculations and what's going wrong with the calculations. A lot of this stuff is 1950 version research, and we're taxing it out with the latest storm events and what, how we go about it. And I've learned from some of the very best as far as that goes. I've read their books and whatnot, but we've got to think about these things in a little bit different way. So, having said that, we probably need to go back to the drawing board again and relook at how you want to do these things. So I encourage you at this point, I guess, to say no and take it to the supervisor, and I'll plead my case there as well. Thank you.
Any questions for Scott? I have a question, Scott, for you and for staff. Would it be possible to just require an engineer's stamp on these developments instead of having all of this?
Currently, Jerry, we have some specific language for erosion control and different practices that can be used. And the only thing we have with regard to stormwater is a reference to using the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual. And that's it. We have no specific requirement that a professional engineer or architect do the reviews. And part of our goal is to when we started looking at this, we looked at other counties, not just cities, not just urban areas, but we patterned or tried to pattern what we were working on with other similar counties. And, you know, we are pulling from the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual. If there's issues with the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual, then there should be work done. There should be a process set out to make changes to it. This is a practice that's commonly used.
You want to put all this in effect. Who's going to be sure it gets done, Jerry?
Our staff will.
And your staff has those expertise.
Right. And we are learning.
It would seem to me be simpler if you just required an engineer to approve the plan.
Jerry, to answer your question directly is there's multiple interpretations of how to meet state law requirements, and it's pretty vague. And it basically says you'll not harm your neighbor, is what it says. So there's a lot of different ways to do that, and I've seen it contested in lawsuits where people didn't do any detention all the way downstream, and they're like, hey, you know, that's just too bad, you know. You had a waterway there, that's where the water's supposed to go, the water stayed in the waterway. The fact that it eroded is, you know, your neighbor's problem, not yours. So I think the standard that I'd like you to put in is, and you know, you're gonna get some grief on this from some people probably, is 5-year existing storm discharge up to a 100-year detained storage for a 100-year event developed condition. That sets the size of the pond. And that's a real easy criteria to do. And it's a one sentence, practically a one sentence thing that you can do. And it accomplishes really 95% of what you want to do in a much simpler way. You do have to have that standard, because otherwise there's always going to be the developer goes, well, really, do I have to do anything here? Right? You always get that. And I'm like, yes, you should do this, you should do that. Well, I don't really want to do that. Well, I think it'd be a good, you know, practice to do that. One of the reasons I wanted the county to participate in, the county engineer in particular to participate in this, is the county's standards for road design and ditch design and drainage are contrary to the Iowa Stormwater Management Manual. I mean, they frankly are, you know, as a standalone project, they don't work, right? I had an instance at Cameron Estates where we had some issues that Jerry brought up. Didn't agree with his assessment, but I said the easiest way for me to do this is to change the culvert sizes in the driveways and slow things down. Went to the county engineer and said, hey, I want to go from an 18 or a 24 inch culvert down to a smaller culvert in order to kind of choke this down and slow it down. He said, well, it's larger than that. So what's going to pond in the ditches? If that's fine, there's nothing there that's going to harm. And if the ditches get full, eventually it flows between the houses where it would have done anyway. Should the culvert even have gotten plugged? Because there's always, you know, the possibility of the culvert get plugged. So I said, there's always, you know, we want things to work even when they don't work, right? Well, the county engineer wouldn't let me do that. So I got him to go from a 24 to an 18, but I still have culverts in the roadway that are larger than I want. And I spent, in addition to fixing what Jerry was worried about, I put in a whole new piping system because the county engineer wouldn't let me do what I thought was the right thing, and I spent another $35,000 putting in more drainage improvements to help with this. So, which then brings up, you know, one of the reasons I did that is, again, especially the infiltration practices. The infiltration practices, that 1.5 inches that they talk about, if you do proper topsoil management, which is not done very well, I'll admit, if you do proper topsoil management, that's taken care of. That's the way most everybody is going to do that, all right? I can guarantee 100% of the plans you get from Fox Engineering will talk about how to deal with the topsoil. But this becomes then a builder issue where I cannot control what those guys do with topsoil, and I don't know where it goes. They bury it, for lack of a better term. And then they put sod on top of that and think that's great. You know, it's not the right way to do things. Doesn't meet the plan requirements that I put together, but that's where, you know, again, some enforcement. But you'll get that, especially in rural developments, you get that like automatically because our lots are large. I mean, they're usually half acre to an acre or more. And so you're just dealing with the house. So if they don't screw up the rest of it, you should have your wall and quality piece automatically. The idea that you're going to infiltrate any of the water in beyond that is again, pure hope. The 0.52 inches is kind of a laughable number, and I'll tell you where it came from. It's a silty sand from Maryland is where they came up with that number. So if you want to know where that came from, that's where it is. There's only about maybe 5% of the soils in Storey County that do that once you get the topsoil. So the topsoil management is a big deal. The rest of it really doesn't matter. And you can't do much after that to make it work. So manage your topsoil, everything else kind of takes care of itself. Again, trying to keep it simple. But my problem is not me, it's not my developer, it's the home builder trying to tell, you know, make him take off the topsoil and put it back on. Can't control it.
Talk about simple.
Have time for staff comments? I mean, not staff, but commission comments?
Sure.
Okay.
If you have any questions or comments.
I don't know. I'm just. I feel like we're kind of beginning to talk in circles here.
This looks very complicated to me.
Well, we talked about it for more than how long have I been on this commission? Maybe 2 years?
At least
now?
A couple of years.
We've talked about this thoroughly. There's this list of folks that have participated in this process. There have been focus groups. I mean, we have one gentleman here who has talked these past two times. The staff has gone bent over backwards to incorporate his comments. Staff has worked on this tirelessly. They are qualified to deal with the inspections. I think we move on with this. And I'd like to move that we pass or we recommend that we move forward with this and sending it to the supervisors.
That's your motion?
That's my motion.
Do we have a motion? Do we have a second? Motion dies for lack of a second. Where do we go from here, Jerry?
Well,
could we have more discussion?
Yeah, more discussion.
We can.
Like I said, we spent 2 years working on this. Scott talked about simple. The stormwater ordinance is two pages. The erosion control, which I think is pretty simply written, that it will not require an engineer to respond to property owners can meet these requirements. The list that you have in front of you is made up of engineers, developers, builders, environmental groups. We have communicated with Mr. Renault each time we have worked on this amendment. We invited him to the work group that we put together a couple of months ago. He did not participate in it.
I do want to address that. Can we have some
order in this?
Yeah, no one addressed that.
Because the last time this meeting kind of devolved. And so.
All right, maybe let me do my thing and then you can respond to it.
That's what
I just wanted to point out that we did invite Mr. Renault to participate in our work group. We hired somebody to moderate it. And we received a lot of good feedback and made adjustments on the ordinance that we had at the time, the amendment, and ended up bringing that to the Planning and Zoning Commission. And, you know, like I said, multiple times we have communicated what our amendment was to Mr. Renault, and we greatly appreciate input. I mean, that's what we're all about. We, to get the input now, this is a public meeting, it's a public forum, but to get it now, there's, you know, he mentioned several things which would really impact the stormwater ordinance. And as Jonathan said, I mean, this is like a redo of the ordinance. We went through that. We took 12 comments, significant comments, spent a lot of time evaluating each of those comments, reached out again to some of the communities that we've been working with that have similar ordinances, put together our response, forwarded it to Mr. Renault and the other engineer. We received comments from the engineer, the other engineer, and this is the version that we're recommending that the Planning and Zoning Commission support so that we can move forward.
Is this just for housing developments, or is this for the whole county farmers that do projects? I understand the corn stock deal. We had one on our farm, plugged 210, over 210. We just did a retention, as you know. Maybe you've been through by it, 210, by the DNR, and it was absolutely uncalled for. So yeah, they did a horrible job. We told them they shouldn't be paid. But so this is, it does get to me when there is too many rules.
Jonathan Hunt is had an illness and was missed 2 months of work. I've been behind, and honestly, I apologize to Jerry profusely on this, that I'm sorry these comments are coming late. When I talked about this in last year, I said the exact same things. Keep it simple. Don't duplicate what the state's already done. And then also recognize that it's different in rural versus city. And this is a city manual, no matter how you like to slice it, it's a city manual.
And we're a growing county.
No, I understand that, but we're not. If you,
I know your argument is that, you know, these things will upset septic systems, right? Is that?
That's one of the things. Yeah.
We are a rural county also.
I mean, we're seeing issues, and I think I've mentioned this before, and I can't, but you know, we're seeing issues with about, and Margaret, the sanitarian, can verify this, but we're seeing issues in a 5-year period on about 10-20% of septic systems on lots. A lot of that is due to high groundwater, and about the other half is due to city people buying a rural house and understanding what a septic tank is and how it works and what you can do.
Well, how do we move forward with this?
I say if there's not enough vote for it now, we table until we have more people.
Well, there was a motion, right, to support it with the changes that staff made that died. So if there's no motion, I think it could go on to the Board of Supervisors, which is...
I move this on to a Board of Supervisors.
Our goal would be to get support from the Planning and Zoning Commission on the amendment.
Just move it on to the supervisor.
If there's no, is there an additional motion?
Can I make another motion?
You certainly may.
In addition to your motion, or do we need to deal with that motion first?
Or no, I don't think she made a motion.
Okay. I move that we accept it. And go with
staff recommendation.
Staff recommendation.
And I would second that motion.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Roll call vote.
Moss.
Yes.
Sherwood.
Yes.
Mins.
No. table?
No.
So that's the vote that'll go to the Board of Supervisors, a 2-2 vote.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, guys.
And for the record, I'd like to say that I do appreciate your input. I do. And I would have loved to have had it before.
I understand that. And I certainly wish I have been to some of the meetings, but I've been out ill for a long time.
Oh, this year?
Yeah. And Amelia asked
to
get back to
that. I don't
understand.
And Jerry, do you want to go ahead with your discussion on that?
The next item is it's a work program item.
I don't think Amelia.
And we were asked to take a look at the subdivisions in the county and make decisions about whether or not the roads in those subdivisions have been dedicated for public use. And we were also asked to take a look at the signage. And Gabriel Nelson, our planning intern, took the reins from our previous intern, Ryan, who did a lot of the groundwork on this work program item. And so we're going to kind of go through this together. But there is 110 subdivisions in the county. And when we first started doing this, we thought maybe we would hit maybe just the more dense townships, but we got through quite a few of them, and we looked at each other and said, you know what, I think we can get through all of them. So we ended up doing that. We took some pretty good site photos. We seen some interesting critters, which we have a photo of one or two of, but he's pulling that up for you. And again, a lot of this involved records research, so he was looking for resolutions and other documents that typically get adopted when a subdivision plat is submitted.
Jerry, why do we care whether these drives have been dedicated to the public?
Well, there was some, probably about maybe a year and a half ago, there have been some questions generated from some of the property owners about installing signs, trying to limit the general public from accessing it. Some of these areas actually they kind of act like a collector road, so they're feeding other subdivisions, and it's a way to get from maybe one east-west road to another east-west road, which would be north of the subdivision.
Right.
So we had requests to the Board of Supervisors, which went to Darren, which our department got involved, and they wanted to know if they could restrict the public from using the road. And so that leads you to think, okay, well, does that mean, you know, the delivery personnel can't use it? What about first responders? We get called quite a bit on complaints. Can we, you know, would we not be permitted to access it? So that's kind of why it became a work program.
Makes sense.
So you kind of see one of the critters that crossed our path.
There's hundreds of them out there.
Are there?
Oh, yeah. Hickory Road. Our road was full of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
He was south of
we picked one up.
Brought the Mar Marietta.
Was that a garland work?
Oh, no. Okay, never mind.
No.
So as Jerry mentioned a little bit of the background. This is a 2018 work program. Tier 2 submission, it was not the first priority work plan, but is in the Tier 2, is number 7. This is just a direct quote from the work plan talking about what we are directed to be doing, looking for if the road's been publicly dedicated or not, and also looking at the current signage of the road. And Jerry did kind of go over that background while he's getting this pulled up. So it started in 2018. You did have Amelia, our planner, who I'm sure you all know. She made a list of 111 subdivisions using GIS mapping. Ryan, the summer intern at that time, then did start collecting data on the public dedication and public exception, different resolutions or covenants that we did have, and we found those in either Tyler Eagle Recorder or the Recorder's Office. If it was before 1985, it was usually found in the recorder's office. And so those are then in our computer. 2019, I took over that process, going up to the recorder's office quite a bit to find that information. And then I also made this into an Excel spreadsheet where I have the subdivision, township, the public exception, public dedication, any easements that allow access, ingress, egress, who is responsible for maintaining the road. And then I also included some of our field work that we did, which was the photos we took of the signs, when we took the photos, and I also included the size of the sign and what the sign said. And I do have that Excel file pulled up on the computer. I was going to print it out, but it was going to be, I believe, 114 pages, so we decided to save some paper.
The county engineer was very interested in that spreadsheet that he worked on, so we're going to make sure that we provide a copy to him.
So in the 111 subdivisions that we went to, we took 41 photos. There's 38 poles that had signs on them. Some poles had more than one sign stacked on top. So in total, there was 47 signs. There was three other photos that we took that were a gate, a permanent basketball hoop, and a post with a light on it.
The basketball hoop was in the, like, built into the cul-de-sac area.
So most of the signs that we did run into were slow down, children at play, caution, child in this area, you know, something to the concerning safety. We did see some speed limit signs, some public-private road signs, some dead-end signs, and a couple stop signs as well. And I just have two slides here to give you a sample of some of the signs that we were taking pictures of. We would have some that kind of appeared to be homemade signs. This says lane private. We had some of the speed limits and the slow down signs. This is where two are stacked over a dead end sign. And then this is the light post and the gate. We're not sure if the gate is operational or just for decoration. And here we have that basketball hoop and private road sign or private drive, a couple of the speed limits, and these are the subdivisions that they're in. And this right here is our route that we kind of took to go to all the subdivisions. The subdivisions are in yellow. You can see most of them are right here in the Franklin Township, north of Ames. That is where the most density of these subdivisions were. You did have another cluster around Huxley and Campbell, but most of them were in the Franklin Township.
We also met with Darren to kind of go over what we found. At this point, we're still, you know, in the information collection stage. The first thing that we wanted to ask from him was whether or not he or his department did any of the installation of the stop signs or any of the other signs, and he assured us that their department did not do that. We had some discussion about, you know, going forward, because we review subdivision plats that are minor, which are four lots and fewer, and then we have the potential to review lots that are larger than that. And we internally had a discussion about creating a template that can be used every time we get a subdivision plat that has the language that addresses the fact that the roads would be dedicated for public use so that the public can access it. We also had a discussion about you know, a possibility of adopting an amendment that gets to, like, uniformity, because as you saw from the photos that Gabe showed, there's all different types of signages, signs, different sizes, different heights. And Darren mentioned that there's the manual on uniform traffic control devices, which could be a helpful resource to use or to refer property owners to homeowners associations. And overall, he commented that that of all the signs, he was concerned about any sign that would restrict the public from having access to it, and less concerned about those that really dealt with public safety. And for the most part, it was like, you know, children at play, for the motorists to be aware of that.
So we, for the Excel document that I created, we found that about 40 of the subdivisions had both a public acceptance and a public dedication. That was so less than half. Seven of them, we found some language that indicated opposition to public dedication. Others were kind of left to interpretation. Some said all acts and deeds were accepted. This kind of led planning staff to wonder what is meant by all acts and what is meant by all deeds, if the plat is an act or a deed. And then, so about 60 of them were publicly dedicated, but so 20 of those weren't necessarily accepted, or we were unable to find the acceptance. So that is part of the reason we do want to have a uniform template for future subdivisions to have public dedication and public acceptance included in the text, just so we're not overlooking that or missing that. So here's our current ordinance on signs. It's the red text. Any sign shall not be erected in the public right-of-way unless done so by a licensed government agency, nor shall signs encroach on the right-of-way. Excuse me. So this is what we currently have, and those were signs, those 38 signs that we had, they were all technically in the public right-of-way.
And I can tell you from our approach, we get calls occasionally from property owners that have questions about installation of signs. And given that we have this ordinance in effect, we always refer them to the engineering department at Secondary Roads so that they can have that discussion. You know, there's been discussions with the county attorney's office about installation of signs. And I think for the most part, it's an accepted activity, provided that they're not trying to do something that's going to keep the general public from being able to access it. You know, if it's a sign that's going to try to keep the area safe, to slow down motorists, that there's children at play, stop signs, those kinds of things, I think the position so far to date has been that those are going to be acceptable. But again, because we have this ordinance, our practice has been to refer them to the county attorney's office so that they can have that discussion about it.
I have a question.
Sure.
Why do we care what somebody signs, somebody puts on their private property?
Well, in the county, the subdivisions are owned and maintained by the property owners, but the roads, for the most part, are dedicated for public use.
I can understand if the roads were dedicated
for public use.
Does that mean that the county then maintains those roads?
The subdivisions in the county are maintained by the property owners.
So the roads are dedicated to the county, but the private property owners maintain
for public
it?
Public access, so that people can, you know, you can take deliveries, that we can go through the subdivision and access properties if we get a complaint. If first responders have a need to go through the subdivision to respond to a call, that they can get through. Visitors who might, you know, be visiting somebody.
That's if they're dedicated.
To give a brief example, this is the spreadsheet that I had put together, and they vary, but many of them are like this, where they had a public acceptance, public dedication. Then for maintenance, it would say homeowners association. Some of them, the wording would be Story County shall not be responsible. this varies as we go down the list. There are written different ways. There are some that we are unable to find some information on, going back to why we want a template that has kind of uniformity. But like this one has owners of lot as maintenance, but it is accepted and dedicated to the county. Others are different. As I kind of scroll down the list, you can see not all of them we were able to find dedication, or some had interesting things written, such as yes, future dedication if you know the road becomes part of a city, or so it is a variety, but a lot of them are both publicly dedicated and accepted, with the homeowner association being responsible. And if I zoom out, you can see I've included all of the signs in this document as well. Majority of the subdivisions did not have any signs.
Do we have gates?
There's one that actually has gates, but like Gabe said, we're not sure if it's actually functional or if it's more decorative. It happened to be open, but...
Because I've been in a lot of them, and you have to give them your name.
Right, or there's like a card key type of situation.
Or, yeah.
Pine Grove Estates is right next to Alluvia Winery.
To the west of it.
They were the one that we were able to see a gate. Photo is kind of small here, but it is a gate on either side. We weren't sure if they closed that gate or if that gate was strictly for outward appearance of...
It was an observation.
Yep.
So if it's a gated community, I'm just asking questions. If it's a gated community, does the county have any...
Well, I think, you know, there needs to be discussion with county departments, responders, the sheriff's office, fire district, ambulance service, because if there's ever a situation where that gate's closed, if it's locked and they can't get through it, that's going to be an issue for somebody. But like, we're just trying to put it out there that it's an observation that we saw. It was open the day that we were there, and it may be that it's decorative. We can't really tell if there's like fasteners at the bottom. I don't recall seeing like a motor, like a hub or something. Maybe you can go back to the big one, of course. Yeah. Zoom in. So, I mean, one thing that we could do as staff is send, if they have a homeowners association, or, you know, send a letter and just inquiry about it. And then, two, we didn't look at the subdivision plat records to see if we have any information on it or any knowledge of it. You know, it's possible that it was constructed without any of any knowledge by the county.
So those signs like dead end, speed limit 15, those have been done by
private property owners. Or homeowners association, they've made decisions to install these signs.
Is there any concern that they look exactly like the ones that are installed by government, so people would have that assumption?
Well, and that's part of why we're doing this inventory, so that we can try to get to that.
And particularly like on the stop sign, because, you know, intersections are... Stop signs have great safety factor to them, and an unqualified person might not be able to, or unqualified group of people may not have enough knowledge to know where to place it, what to do with it, if it has unintended consequences from the other direction or something like that.
We did speak to Darren about this. He didn't seem to have any major concerns. He did say with stop signs, though, or any other sign that they do put up, they do assume liability if there is an accident or something, and they have put that stop sign in their subdivision. They could be liable for damages or whatever does if something were to go wrong with that stop sign. So there is the factor that if you put in a stop sign in your subdivision, you're liable for what happens with that stop sign.
While we have that provision in the ordinance that indicates that if a sign is to be installed in the public right-of-way, that it should be by a government entity, we don't have anything in place. We don't have a practice in place to address signage. But again, I think this is something that can be discussed. This is why we are looking into this. It could be communicated to the landowner, to the developer.
Jerry, I have a question. So if this private road is dedicated to the county, then they can't put a sign on there that says homeowners only or no public access then?
The dedication is for public use, so that the public be permitted to
if it's
access.
Dedicated, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense.
Right. But and then, so again, but this work program item could lead toward, the practice of our department, whether it be like a formal ordinance or just a discussion, that we have a discussion with all landowners, all developers, engineers about signage, about practices, maybe referencing them to the manual that we mentioned so that we have uniformity. Because again, I think our informal position with regard to signage is that I think they're supported, provided that they're not trying to restrict the public from accessing the road. And we've had some questions, some requests to do that. We've got a few areas in the county where the road is actually, it's somewhat set up as a collector. And so other subdivisions or other road systems feed into it, and it's a way to get from one east-west road to a north east-west road, and that activity is not supported by some of the landowners. And so that's that, and some other comments that we received prompted us to look into this. It was when a previous board member was here.
Just a question for my own use. Are all, even at a very low maintenance level, are all government roads have some sort of signage somewhere on them?
The county roads?
Yes. The low maintenance. But so is the assumption, I'll just use the example of what I'm thinking about. I like to go in the back way at McFarland Park by Pleasant Grove Church, and there's a lane there that runs to the back side of McFarland Park. And
on the east side of the park?
North side?
Just west of the freeway?
Yes. And there may be
it's
a
sign. It's an easement
there.
I think.
It's an easement.
I think so.
So it is.
If it's where I'm thinking, it's on the east side of the park, and it's just west of the freeway.
And so that having no signage there would indicate, if it wasn't, there would be a sign there.
Yeah, that is actually county property. And I know a little bit about this because of that road race that we had.
It
was
they,
in that area.
They
it came up.
Go by my house.
We had to make sure that we had support from the conservation board for them to actually use that property, because they were using that for the road course, part of that, the east side of that property.
That answers that question.
Yeah, it's an easement.
So those stop signs look just like the state stop signs. Can you buy those?
Yes, you can purchase speed limit signs, stop signs. They had those. Were all online. When I was looking up the sign dimensions, how large the signs were, we often kind of estimated as we were taking photos, but I went online and you can get the exact measurements. You can buy them. They're all on Amazon and similar. There's sites that are dedicated to selling signs too. So you can.
Probably, you know, there's different sources probably, and there's different variations to what would be like a certified stop sign, but it's probably close to what would be something that would meet a standard. So that brings us to like some findings. Again, this is a discussion item. It's not an action item. We've already mentioned it a couple times. We think it would be beneficial if we put together like a template so that the wording with regard to roads is consistent, that the roads be publicly dedicated for public use. So that was the first thing that we observed.
Second thing we observed is we were going through public dedications and private dedications, but we noted that there was no definition of what publicly dedicating or privately dedicating a road meant. So just to add a thought that we had was it'd be useful to add that to our definitions chapter and to compose a definition for those items.
And again, just getting to like dealing with future subdivisions, I think we can probably do more to talk about signs with developers, landowners, maybe get some information out on our website with regard to that. And again, I think for the most part, our position, informal position, is as long as it has an element of public safety, those signs are supported and can stay.
Then, as we mentioned, the gates, solution going forward would be to discuss with county engineers, first responders, fire, et cetera, and then develop some type of regulation depending on the outcome of our discussions, what we decide on, what are county's thoughts on gates, just for a future item.
Well, the first thing is we need to talk to the property owners to find out what's the intent of it. Maybe it's decorative. It looked like it was large enough that it could be closed. But that's probably our first step before we did anything else, to get some information from property owners about it. One of the things that we observed, it wasn't why we were out there, but there's a lot of what seems to be narrow roads. We only came across a situation a few times where we were coming upon somebody who was either coming into the subdivision or leaving. Currently, we have a pretty good practice in place with working with the engineering secondary roads when we review subdivision plats to do the inspections. We didn't put a tape to it, but we have a minimum standard for roads that would be for like minor subdivisions of 22 feet in width, and our observation was that these likely were not 22 feet in width. They were more closer to a design that would be similar to like a driveway or like a lane. And in most cases, though, there was space on either side of it that a car, or if emergency a vehicle were approaching, that a car could move off to the side. But that's, again, something that we observed.
So that is the builder's problem.
Developer.
Developer.
Yeah, and it's something that should be picked up with an inspection process. And like I said, we do those inspections. Most of what we're getting right now, though, are residential parcel subdivisions, which don't require roads. We get very few subdivisions with roads. There's no road requirement until you have 5 or greater lots. And so I think since I've been here, there's only been maybe 1 or 2 with roads. And then we had an observation about size signs, because there seems to be all different sizes and heights, and a suggestion of referring people or maybe adopting a standard such as the uniform traffic control device might be a positive step in the right direction.
Then our current ordinance right now, any sign shall not be erected in the public right-of-way unless done so by a licensed government agency, nor shall signs encroach on the right-of-way. We'd continue to support that, and what we've been doing is just referring people to Darren, and Darren has been county engineer, has been kind of making the call on that.
Right now we have provisions in the ordinance that address private streets versus public streets. I think we have a definition for private, which is four or fewer lots, but we don't define public streets. But we do have definition for minor and major subdivision, which is where all this comes into play anyway. Because if it's a minor subdivision, you're allowed to take access off of a county road. But it's when you have the five or greater, then there's a road and a paving requirement. And again, at this point, discussion of dropping private in lieu of like a public street definition, with the goal of, again, assuring that all streets be accessible by the general public. And so that would be the goal with that one.
I don't know if I'd go along with that. I would think if it's private ground, why do I have to let the public on?
Well,
I don't want people driving into my driveway.
Do you want deliveries? Do you want emergency response?
That's their problem, not our problem. Fire safety, that's their problem. We don't need to be Big Brother. They can, if they want to close that gate and somebody needs an ambulance, that's not my problem.
There's thousands of gated communities. They must have...
Many of them are staffed by their security. I mean, there's actually someone standing there letting people in and out.
That's just my opinion. You know, and if it's not a dedicated road, why would we have the right to tell them what to use for signage?
Well, and that's part of what we were trying to uncover. And in some cases, it's not clear, or we have no records of what the status is.
I was going to ask you about that, too. Is you don't really have records of what's dedicated and what's not?
For some of these.
Yeah. There. That would be good to know.
Right, right, exactly.
So we do have for, this is the document we have that talks about yes or no if it was dedicated. If it says no, then it typically means we weren't able to find it. But there were occasionally some that would, there's about seven of them that I was able to find out of the 111 that had some type of wording that indicated that it was not dedicated to the public. The majority of them, we either didn't have the information or they were dedicated to the public in some way. Some of them had no dedication. They're a private street, but they had an easement for ingress, egress for the public to use for deliveries and maintenance. I know you had mentioned private roads having some right to restrict vehicles. I did see a couple that would dedicate the roads to the public, except for, I'm trying to think of the words, except for large trucks or vehicles that
like
would,
since
they're the ones maintaining the road, they had some ability to restrict for maintenance purposes, but generally they would have an easement to allow the public, or they would have a dedication of the road to the public.
There is a minimum width requirement that they are currently required to comply with. There's also an exception that they can request from the county engineer too, but we have received calls before about trying to restrict heavy trucks from accessing subdivision roads.
I found out something at my shop and office areas, storage unit areas. I had a vehicle that sat there for like 4 or 5 weeks. Didn't belong to anybody there.
So I called your property?
On my property. I called the police department to come down and ticket it and have it towed. So the lady from enforcement came down and said, we can't do that because you don't have a sign that says authorized vehicles only. I said, I have to have a sign that says that? Yeah, if you want it. Oh, so I said, I can bring my truck and put it in your front yard and you can't do a thing about it then? Because you don't have a sign that says...
Is that a city ordinance? Was she referencing?
It's evidently a city ordinance. That was very surprising to me. So I guess you can just park forever.
Are you going to get a sign?
Oh, I got one the next day.
Okay.
Yeah. Then I had a tow. Yeah.
Which is very sad to me. If it's private property.
Strange.
So did you have anything else, Gabe?
This is just one that I was able to find that did not have a public dedication, Lohman's Fourth Subdivision. It said no public dedication. The city said there will be no public dedication. Or I meant the county. I'm sorry, Story County. But there was an ingress egress to the public roadway. So there is access to it for the public to use, but it's not dedicated. And a lot of times that might be some type of drive that they have that is the subdivision's built on a county road, and then they have a drive going back. So,
again, this is a discussion item only, but our goal, because it's a work program item, is that we would like to come back to the Planning and Zoning Commission. You know, we put together some things that would involve us doing additional work. Are there additional comments? Jerry mentioned some concerns about the last item about limiting or cutting private streets. That language from the ordinance. Is there any other thing or any other suggestions that the commission has? And then two, we would go to the county attorney's office with any work that we do before coming back to the Planning and Zoning Commission and then going on to the Board of Supervisors. Any other observations or suggestions or comments? Anybody?
I'm still troubled
okay.
by the sort of fake government signs. I mean, like giving the impression like that when I see, like on my road, very curvy road, I see 15 miles per hour on this curve and probably barely notice it because I've driven it hundreds of times and may or may not live up to that speed limit. But I assume on a county road that it's that speed limit for a reason. There's been a study on it. And if I see a 20 mile per hour and it really is only safe at a 5 or 10 miles per hour, that gives people a false sense of security to do donuts in the
Darren confirmed that they have not installed any of the signs that are there, which would include the speed limit signs. And I think oftentimes the limits are set by ordinance, which are ultimately, in this case, would be acted on by the Board of Supervisors and often involve a study. They look at accident records, a lot of different data to make decisions about, you know, how to stagger speeds, how to slow down the traffic based on what type of road system it is and you know, what's approaching, that kind of thing. But there were varying speed limits, you know, 15, I think, was there 25?
Yeah, there was a couple different, I'd have up the 215s. Is there a limit for subdivisions, though, a county limit?
I think it's by ordinance how that's established. I think back to in the time, like drivers taking that test. It seems like to me business was a...
School's 25.
25, and then business 20. I don't know if that's a state standard.
So
I remember taking...
Those signs are based on an ordinance?
Usually.
But it can...
She's asking about the signs of the subdivision.
Oh, and these?
No.
Yeah. I'm talking about county.
Yeah,
signs.
And
or in
so,
a case of a city,
so it is
sign.
For a reason that they're made that. I mean, for the government ones are for a reason, but this implies that there's been a study or safety factors considered and not just somebody's opinion.
This is based on what they think is acceptable.
And usually it would probably be a safety deal that they would...
Usually they want to slow vehicles down.
Usually they want it, but I would never put a 15... On my county road, I would never put that curve as a 15 because I'm used to driving it and nobody ever drives it at that speed. But there's a good reason to do it if, you know, right. and so I don't have that kind of knowledge, and that would concern me.
Jerry, you want to move on to 7-Eleven?
Sure.
7.2.
I'll try to be real brief. This is a work program item. We were to review the land development regulations and smart growth strategies and try to determine if our regulations limit the natural disaster impacts with regard to development. There's a reference to this in the C2C plan under emergency preparedness under 3.7 under the foundation chapter. The goal of the program, work program item again, was to identify smart growth development strategies, which are listed in the bold. They are adopted by the American Planning Association. So again, we were supposed to compare our standards with these strategies and try to, you know, make decisions about whether or not, we're effectively addressing natural resources. In this case, you know, trying to limit natural disasters such as flooding was actually specifically identified. But we pulled some of the strategies, mixed land uses. Again, counties typically don't have a lot of mixed uses. You're going to see more of a mixed use the more dense you get, with residential densities being in close proximity, or maybe a commercial use in a lower level building with residential uses on top. But we do have some flexibility built in our ordinance to allow a residential overlay, which allows for some limited, like retail type uses. Smart growth strategy, addressing flexible land use policies. And I think that could be somewhat subjectivity. Ordinances that provide a varying lot size, which ours does that to some degree. We have agricultural residential, which is a 1 acre lot. R1 is a little over half acre, 25,000 square feet. And then R2, you can do like a 6,000 square foot, like a bi-attached type housing situation. Preserving open space, farmland, beauty, and critical environmental areas. I think for the most part, our ordinance addresses that. It's certainly addressed in multiple locations in the comprehensive plan. Focus on developing in existing areas to try to limit the impact of development, you know, preserving natural resources. Our comprehensive plan certainly addresses that. Development decisions that are predictable, fair, and cost-effective. We just went through a process about a year ago of adopting processes for all of our development case reviews for conditional uses, rezonings, subdivision plats, to be more clear on what's required. Collaboration with development stakeholders and applicants, we work hard to do that. We tried to do that with the stormwater ordinance. We've done that with home business ordinance. We also do outreach after ordinances are adopted. 7, target public investment to spear private investment. You know, we don't have a lot of public investment per se in the county. Paving of roads is costly. You know, we've paved a few roads, and sometimes that might impact requests to change land use. We don't have sanitary sewer or water systems. rebuilding according to community vision. Again, that's the comprehensive plan that we adopted in 2016. And then being prepared for the next disaster. We have this system called COOP-COG, which is continuity of operations plan and continuity of government. And it's, if a tornado comes and levels this building, how will we be able to, you know, operate and conduct services? How will all the other departments do that? And so we have a plan in this COOP-COG policy of how we would address a tornado or, you know, if the electricity is cut. And so every department has an understanding of how we would go forward in providing the services that we provide. At least that's the goal, is to have a plan to do that. We also have an emergency management commission and an EOC. We have training all the time. Flood ordinance, floodplain ordinance. So again, we looked at all of these different items that I just addressed. I provided some details here. I can address them if you'd like. Again, the mixed land use, we do have the ability to allow a residential mixed use overlay district in an R1 or R2 that does permit certain retail uses, convenience commercial type uses. Whether or not our land use policies are flexible, we allow development to occur in natural resources up to 15%. Anything more than that, then there's a mitigation requirement. We don't require paving for smaller subdivisions or minor subdivisions. We don't have a minimum parking standard, we have a maximum. So a lot of parking standards have a minimum requirement. You have, for this use, you have to put in 10 spaces. For this use, it requires 25. Ours is a maximum. We don't want to see a certain number threshold. So this allows the business owner, the property owner, to decide what's best, and then they can make adjustments as, you know, their business grows. Mm-hmm. So I think those things provide the flexibility in the land uses. Again, I think our comprehensive plan and our ordinances are full of language for open space, farmland protection, beauty, protecting environmental areas, developing in existing areas. Part of our work program is we're to look at existing developments. We did that with the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. We did that review of the north area, which included the northeast, the northwest, and try to come up with some scenarios, options for landowners. You know, if the market conditions were right, and if changes were supported by the three entities, Story County, Gilbert, and Ames, that changes could take place. And these were primarily in areas where there was existing development. Again, collaboration with development stakeholders and applicants. Again, we work hard to try to reach out to stakeholders when we're working on proposed amendments. Targeting public investment to spur private investment. I kind of talked about that. We don't have a lot of public utilities in the county. There was some interest with the paving that took place on Grant in the Ames River Fringe to maybe do some different things there. And again, we did the review to address some of those things. Community vision, rebuild according to that. We have the C2C plan. We have language that's addressed in the ordinance for when you can rebuild, and also the county and the FEMA requirements for substantial damage. We have to follow that criteria, based on whether or not improvements can be made. And then being prepared for the next disaster. Again, we have a COOP-COG plan. We have exercises periodically. We have a hazard mitigation plan. We have a community rating system, which gets to, we have standards in the floodplain ordinance that are more restrictive than the FEMA requirements, which in effect lowers the insurance rates for those that are impacted, that build or make improvements in the floodplain. And then so with all that, we put together some statements about supporting, with regard to mixed use, mixed land uses, supporting mixed uses maybe in the urban growth area. Those are areas in the comp plan that are close to cities, provided that they're supported by cities, where rezoning would be supported. The underlying district needs to be R1, R2, and then the rezoning would be for the residential mixed. But again, the way it's set up is that if we get a development request there, we work with the city to see if they have plans to annex. If not, a lot of those requests fall to the city to have the applicants follow our standard. Flexible land use policies, again, I kind of talked about some of that. Preserving open space. We're proposing to make some improvements to the stormwater ordinance. Require developments in the AR, R1, R2 districts to be conservation design. Again, we have a conservation overlay district. Since I've been here, I don't know that anybody's actually used it. But the focus would be on trying to preserve the trees, the wetlands, other natural resources within the development, and then provide incentives to developers to maybe allow them to plat, to increase density, to have a few more lots than what would normally be permitted. Development decisions that are predictable, fair, and cost-effective. Again, we think that our processes are pretty transparent. We do have amendments that we worked on for our processes. Collaboration and development stakeholder and applicants. Again, we do work hard to reach out. Part of my work goal is to do more outreach. We are going to be adopting a new software package for permitting and case development. It's something that the Board of Supervisors approved. It's going to impact all of the property owners who submit zoning permits, those that submit development case applications. So there's going to be an education process that needs to take place there. And then just following our community vision for changes, and then if we do have a disaster, are we prepared to respond to it? And again, I think through our COOP-COG, hazard mitigation planning, the training that we do in the EOC, usually we have at least two major exercises where it's like a half a day. I think those things are helpful for our preparedness. So it's not an action item, it's a discussion item. Any comments?
I'm glad you kept that brief.
Well, there's a lot of stuff there.
Anything else, Jerry?
That's it.
Commission, anything? Anybody? I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. So moved. We are adjourned.